long have you been 17?
I am a vampire, and you are mortal.
Hello, and welcome to This Podcast Sucks,
the show where we take a bite out of the vampire genre.
We'll be following all manner of fanged fiends through the past 127 years of film and television.
From Nosferatu to Twilight, I'm your host, Tara.
And I'm your host, Elliot.
And today we will be talking about 1943's The Return of the Vampire, starring none other than Bela Lugosi. Woo!
Yes, the vampire is returning for audiences in 1943. For us, he never went anywhere.
Yes, so the vampire has returned. And I'm curious, Elliot, did you know at all about this film's existence before this show? I can't say I did either. As we've started doing the show, I've become a little more aware of Bela Lugosi's kind of coming in and out of playing these vampire roles. But technically, he has only played Dracula twice, that being in 1931 Todd Browning Dracula, and then in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein officially. So in this film, Bela is playing a different vampire, Armand Tesla, but the film is often considered to be kind of an unofficial sequel to Dracula. The only issue being here that it is a Columbia Pictures film, not a Universal Studios film. So cannot technically call him Dracula, even though he is, for all intents and purposes, pretty much playing Dracula. So,
yeah, I think this, it's funny that, because, you know, talking about the undead, we talk about undying and immortality a lot. And one thing that refuses to die is copyright issues. We have seen this with most of the films we've talked about. We saw it with Nosferatu. We saw it with, there's just been constant issues with making films about Dracula.
There certainly has been, and maybe that's the reason we get so many different Draculas in our cultural lexicon. But before we start talking about the movie, I figured I'd give a little bit of some background information. So the film is directed by so the film's directed by Lou Landers, written by Randall Fay and Griffin J. And as I said earlier, it is considered specifically by cultural historian David J. Skull as an unofficial sequel to 1931's Dracula, essentially because it was not produced by Universal. The cast includes Bela Lugosi as Armand Tesla, Nina Folkfosh, not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, as Nikki Saunders, Roland Varno as John Ainsley, Frida Inniscourt as Lady Jane Ainsley, Miles Mander as Sir Frederick Fleet, Matt Willis as Andreas Aubrey, Otella Nesmith as Elsa Walter, Gilbert Emery as Dr. Walter Saunders, Leslie Dennison as Detective Lynch, William Austin as Detective Gannett, and let's see, Charlie Collier as Nikki as a child, Donald Dewar as John as a child, Olaf Hyten as Ben, and Nelson Lee as assistant. So the film was produced by Columbia Pictures. I couldn't find a specific budget. Based on what I saw in the film, I was assuming low. And that is what's...
You don't think all that smoke cost money?
that 10 by 10 foot graveyard.
Okay, fair.
Well, yeah, I mean, but sources seem to confirm that theory that it is low budget. But Columbia, I guess, was essentially kind of trying to replicate the Universal Pictures monster movie method, and or just trying to kind of capitalize on, I read this term, they were called like sausage factory horror films because you just produced them so quickly, like sausage in a factory, I guess.
That is so funny because was it The Vampire Bat or Condemned to Live that was like a quickie? They called it like a quickie.
Yeah, oh, they both were. I think it was The Vampire Bat that was pretty much a quickie. So the film was released November 11th, 1943. And in terms of critical reception, audience opinion, again, couldn't find a whole lot from the time, but I did find an incredible New York Times article that I will read quickly. It is called Any Bloody Donors, just written by the initials BC. It says, need we say more about a picture called The Return of the Vampire than just that, plus the fact that Columbia made it and it opened at the Rialto yesterday. Are you still interested? All right. We'll tell you that Bela Lugosi rises again from the grave to go about sucking transfusions from the throat of a beautiful girl in the dark of night while mists rise around the English mansion and dogs howl mournfully on the hill. But his accomplice, a hairy-faced man-beast, proves his undoing in the end. This monster gets religion or something and turns the vampire into dust with a crucifix. Thus the forces of good triumph over evil, and we all can feel much better until next time. Amazing. This reviewer was so done.
Yeah, and it's that review really affects mirrors the film and how it's just kind of so matter of fact. Things happen, they don't really matter, you don't really feel that much about it.
How he says that the monster gets religion or something. And
yes, but it's true, because it's like, is he getting religion, or what happens in that moment?
Yeah,
at the end,
it like becomes a fight for, you know, that who is that character, Andreas. No, yeah, it becomes like a fight for his soul at the end, and I'm like, okay, I guess. And so in terms of fun facts, I couldn't, again, find a whole lot, but I would just say I think this is... No one cares about this movie, I guess.
This movie was like a tree falling in the forest.
Well, actually, no, here is a fun fact. It is the last time Lugosi would receive top billing for a film. So yeah, that's kind of the last time there, but it is the first vampire film we've seen set during a very specific cultural political moment, which is World War II, and where the sociopolitical climate actually comes to matter in terms of the plot. It like intervenes in the plot, especially at the end, which we will talk about, which I think is interesting. So, yeah,
no, I totally agree. We've definitely had films where, like, the zeitgeist was present, but we haven't had a film that was so clearly tied to, like, very specific historical events. So that is really interesting.
Yes. Yeah. And in terms of legacy, as I said, this is kind of Lugosi's unofficial last reprise of a Dracula-esque character in a straight horror film. The only other time he would officially play Dracula was technically in a comedy. So in 2006, Susan King of the Los Angeles Times called the film underrated. And in 2019, Stuart Galbraith, the fourth, I believe, of DVD Talk wrote, "For all its faults, The Return of the Vampire is as close as audiences got to see Lugosi reprise his role as Count Dracula in all but name in a straight horror film. And low budget though it is, the picture is in some respects more ambitious than Universal Sausage Factory horrors, at least story-wise, and notable for its imitation Universal look, a remarkable achievement for such a cheap film."
I have to say, I don't agree with Susan at all. I think this film is very appropriately rated.
Elliot's like, it's very deservedly underrated. What? Yeah, I think the shade of Lugosi and his legacy maybe clouds her judgment. I don't know, or clouds these reviewers' judgments. We're like, no, it's actually really underrated and good. I'm like, no, what was the one, Mark of the Vampire with Lugosi and the daughter? Like, that's an underrated one. That's one I liked.
Yes.
For all of its very weird faults. So all right. I think we can probably get into it and start talking about the film here.
Yes.
All right. So in Return of the Vampire, we open during World War One, where the vampire Armand Tesla stalks London, and his latest victim is admitted to the clinic of Lady Jane Ainslie and her colleague, Professor Walter Saunders. So I think I have in my notes the opening, what is like the opening quotes from the narrator. It's like, or I forget if it's on screen text. It's like, the imagination at times sees the fantastic and the grotesque, that the imagination of man can soar into the stratosphere of fantasy is attested by the Return of the Vampire, and it has like that cheesy zoom in.
Yes, it is on screen. Yeah, the text is on screen, and there's a woman that as the camera zooms in, she screams.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, no,
yeah,
that was very funny. And okay, I think this is the first person we see is Andreas, who is kind of like Armand's familiar. And I don't know what you thought, but when I first saw him, I was thinking, like, is this like, is there also a werewolf in the film?
Yeah, I was like, it is so funny that the first scene of the film Return of the Vampire is a random wolfman / werewolf.
I was confused. I was like, are we getting a crossover already? So I was just thinking, okay, is it a werewolf? Is it someone with hypertrichosis? So we then come to, I guess, the very teeny tiny lair where Armand the vampire is, and we get the classic hand coming out of the coffin. I feel like the director was just saying to Lugosi, like, just do everything you did in Dracula. I don't know, do whatever you did there. And so we get that classic hand coming out. But I will say, I felt watching these early scenes, like, I felt like the music was really overbearing. I don't know if you thought that too. And it just made me, again, appreciate how much more effective the original Dracula is without any music. Or non-diegetic sound.
I agree. I actually have in my notes towards the end that there is nothing significant or impressive about the score or the cinematography or the editing.
No.
Yeah, so not at I don't all. Think the and score as we saw, the score does very little for the film.
The score does little, and it's just too much doing too little. And as we also saw by the 10-foot by 10-foot graveyard, it's not a well-funded film. It is pretty cheap looking. A lot of fog machines covering it up.
That's such a great point. That they're probably trying to cover the ground so you can see less of the set.
So, but I will say, I think this is like Armand, has his first victim, and we come to Lady Jane Ainslie. And I wrote in my notes, women doing science, yay! And I will say, she is the best part of this movie. She is awesome. She's our first female vampire hunter in these movies, I think.
Yes, that's actually true, because we have had woman scientists or, female scientists, but I think there was one in Condemned to Live, but she wasn't really... She wasn't like the mover and shaker of the story.
Right. And I think like Fay Wray's character in The Vampire Bat, it was, but she was just kind of there to be the love interest. But no, Lady Jane Ainslie is a badass, and I like that for the majority of the film she's not like just constantly bombarded with people being like, you're a woman, you can't do this. I like that most of the other characters like treat her pretty much like an equal. There's a little bit of like condescension from like the inspector guy a bit. He's always like, my idea. But for the most part, I'm like, okay, she's treated on a pretty level, equal ground to the other male characters, I feel like.
I think that the inspector character is similar to basically every single one of these films that we've talked about. He's the skeptic. Like, we need a skeptic. There needs to be someone who doesn't believe. And so I think that some of his condescension comes a bit more from him filling that role of the person who like the disbelief.
Exactly.
It felt like that had more to do with it than he was being like, you silly woman.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. And so when we come to Lady Jane Ainslie and the victim, they think it's like a really severe case of anemia. And then we get a scene very similar to Dracula's daughter, I thought, with the hypnosis. She's like, she's in shock. Yeah. And so they're like, it's almost hypnosis. So again, very similar to Dracula's daughter. And then I write in my notes, yay, vampire book of knowledge. Because we always have to have a vampire book of knowledge. So so far in these movies. Yeah. So I think this is around when Armand the vampire kind of infiltrates the clinic. And he tries to finish off the victim there. But she has died from shock. And yeah, so then he goes.
Sort of has that moment where she's reliving. Yeah. Her the like the because she's sort of trapped in that fugue state of like she's talking to someone who isn't there and reliving the moment, and then yes, she just dies of shock kind of one moment to the next.
Yeah, and I think I said what was I gonna say? Yeah, so he comes to the children of Lady Jane Ainslie's colleague Professor Walter Saunders, or at least that's where his granddaughter is. And I think Lady Jane Ainslie also has her son in there as well, I want to say. But so anyway, Armand comes to... Yeah, because they're engaged, aren't they, later in the film? Which I was very confused about. This is the second time.
Yes.
I thought, yeah, no, I thought they were siblings too. And I was like, wait, what is happening? Yeah, so I think that's
keeping it in the family.
Yeah. So I think that is Lady Jane Ainslie's son and Professor Saunders' granddaughter. And I write, uh-oh, will those kids be all right? And this is the first time we've seen a vampire attack a child. So
yes,
in a movie.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk about that, actually, because up to this point, it has been pretty sexually, like, coded when a vampire attacks someone. Like, you know, I want to talk about this more later, but, you know, Dracula has a type. He's like always going after these young women. And so this is the first time that we see an attack on a child. You're correct. And I guess, like, you know, she's in bed, though. He, like, sneaks into her bedroom, similarly to all of these films.
Well, I was just going to say really quickly, yes, just like you said, there's always been a sexualized element to Dracula attacking these young women. And this is the first time he attacks a child. But again, when he comes back and she's older, the sexualized element is reintroduced because he wants to, like, take her for his bride or whatever. So there's almost like an uncomfortable kind of I don't know, like, grooming element a bit.
There is I agree. I mean, I think you don't necessarily have to read it this way, but it is difficult, especially if you watch all of these films in succession the way we have been doing. It is difficult not to read some sort of pedophilic element there, because he sneaks into her bedroom, he menaces her, he, like you're saying, there is a grooming element where he's talking to her and telling her things that will come to influence her later in life. And then when she's an adult, his obsession has not abated at all. If anything, it's gotten more intense. So I totally agree that there's something kind of menacing and dangerous about this in that hasn't been the case in past films. Like, this is more like, I find this more objectionable and disgusting than a more typical, like, you know, young woman that he's going after.
Sure, sure. And like you said, you certainly don't have to read it that way, but it's almost kind of like it's taken as a given that no matter the age, if the victim of Dracula or whatever vampire is a female, there has to be a sexualized element to it. It's like, okay, then I guess in this one, we're waiting 15 years to add that, or 10 years. And
yeah, I think so, it was 20. I think it was like 20
or 20 years. Yeah. It's like, okay, in this one, it's like, well, we'll get there. Just wait 20 years, it's like, sure, why not? Ugh. So
yeah. And it's like, I guess you could read this as I will say Dracula, as Tesla kind of like picking up where he left off, like that Nikki was the last victim that he tried to kill or bring into his thrall before this time jump. Like, you could see it that way, that he's like a completionist and that he's like, I can't.
But, no, that's true. Yeah. It could just be Armand being a completionist here. It could totally be that. Yeah. I did write, though, I think it's when we see him outside the window. I just said, okay, he's not a vampire. He's Jack the Ripper, because he has like the top hat and the cloak and everything.
Yes, I noticed. And, like,
it's Jack the Ripper.
I think that more than any of the others, opens a reading of Dracula as just an incel.
Actually, no. That's from the beginning, Elliot. Nosferatu was the original incel. and subsequent adaptations have only played that up. When we get to the Herzog version, he's peak incel in that one. I don't know what the Robert Eggers one's going to do with it, but we'll see.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see like what the especially because now the idea of an incel has kind of started to creep its way into media. You know, like the Batman kind of had some elements that have to do with like isolated young men who are just like angry at the world and like not getting the things that they think they deserve.
Yeah, sure. I think it's something that became much more prominent slash just people just became more aware of that, that identity, that kind of person. And then with that awareness, they kind of were able to maybe notice similar traits, I think, with figures in media and kind of go, oh, wait, sort of. Yeah. Not that Batman is an incel, but, you know, let's.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. I don't know. Well,
look, he's got good people in his life keeping him on track. He's got Alfred. Yeah. I don't know where we're going with this. Anyways.
I just think, this is an aside. I just think it's funny to read. It's just funny to look at Dracula as like, because he's this kind of like all powerful being that can psychically control you and kill you. And so then it's just very funny to flip it on its head and view him as this kind of pathetic guy.
Right. Okay. But question, like, what if is he still an incel? Like in the Bram, like the Francis Ford Coppola Dracula, because I feel like Gary Oldman has too much. I was going to say, Gary Oldman has too much riz in that movie. He can't be an incel. He is way too confident. And even though he's still like a simp, like we'll give him simp status. He's like simping, I think. But.
Okay, yeah. I think maybe perhaps simp is a more accurate description than incel. Because you're right that each time we see Dracula, he's like really obsessed with this one woman and goes to all this trouble for this one woman. So that is definitely simp behavior.
I think it just depends on which Dracula you're getting. Nosferatu Dracula, 100% incel. But, you know, Gary Oldman Dracula, he's kind of cool. Like I said, he has too much riz. He can't quite be an incel.
Yeah. I think that Gary Oldman Dracula in his youth had like crazy, was like partying hard.
Oh, yeah. Like you said, he fucks.
A rake.
Granted, a bit of a rake, 100%. Like, granted, I know I said he's cool. I am not condoning Dracula in that movie. He does a lot of fucked up stuff.
But we can say
Gary Oldman brought what he brought to it. And oh my gosh, we are going to have
and
like
what he
a
brought
five
was a horny was vibe.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's just like, it's like adult horny too. Like I remember Natalie Wynn from ContraPoints, she tweeted while she was watching the movie and she was just like, I forgot when movies were this horny. And it's like,
yes. Yeah, there's been like a 40% decline in sex scenes or something absolutely ridiculous like that in the past couple of years. Yeah. I think we're definitely in a much more prudish time.
For a lot of reasons.
10 years ago or 20 years ago.
Yeah, for all the reasons we've talked about in other episodes. I'm excited to talk about Bram Stoker's Dracula 20 years from now. So anyway,
coming back to old and decrepit.
When we're old and give me eternal life, Gary. Anyway, coming back to returning to Return of the Vampire. So Armand attacks, what was the daughter's name?
Nikki.
And so, Lady Jane and Professor Saunders see the puncture marks and they both know it's a vampire, pretty quickly. Like Jane again is a badass and kind of the most rational person in the movies. Cause she just, you know, assumes what most people would assume, a bat, an animal. And then the doctor just goes, no, Romanian scientist Armand Tesla goes, according to Dr. Tesla, a vampire's face casts no reflection when it looks in a mirror. So I think just a quick aside on that little caveat, the whole vampires don't have reflections. That actually originated in Bram Stoker's Dracula. That is not a part of, you know, older vampire, you know, lore. It's not a, like, it's not a cultural thing. It's just something Bram Stoker made up. But it's interesting to see how recent addition to vampire lore mythos is kind of made to seem more legitimate by, in this movie, attributing it to a fake old Romanian vampire expert. So
who's named Tesla? Like, Tesla was alive and significant at this point, right? Showing the gaps in my history knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
but
it was.
I found it quite like, distracting his name was Tesla.
Armand Tesla. I'm like, that doesn't sound, I don't know if that's Romanian. I won't speak to that. So Saunders comes to believe that both patients are victims of a vampire in everything. And so he and Lady Jane search the nearby cemetery for the vampire's crypt. They find Armand. They hold a mirror to his face. No reflection. Proves he's a vampire. And then we have probably the most bored staking I've ever seen in my life. Like, Saunders is just so over it.
Yeah.
Just like... Sure.
The stake is kind of funny because it looks exactly like a giant nail. Like, it doesn't really look like a stake. It just looks like a huge nail.
I mean, I guess whatever gets the job done, but I thought it had to be wood. I don't know. Andreas, who, as we said earlier, was the very hairy man assisting Armand, he tries to intervene but doesn't succeed. And then once the vampire Armand is staked, Andreas is cured of his curse. And I'm just kind of like, this is a really fucked up connotation to have, like... Having a lot of hair means you're cursed. Because, I mean, it's, I don't think it's unfounded to say that, you know, the look of werewolves around this time in media was essentially what someone with hypertrichosis would look like. And so
it
to just
definitely
have
feels
that
very freak show.
Very freak show. It has the connotation of, you know, your external appearance equates to your internal morality. Very dated conceptions about appearance in that manner. But you know, 1943. So it's still bad, still messed up.
I think it's also one thing that I think is interesting about it though, is that it's the first time that we've seen a vampire be able to like forcibly physically transform their familiar or thrall.
Yes. That's a really good point, because up until now we've only seen how when vampires have their familiars, it's always like a very much a control and distortion of their mind.
Yes. And So, I mean, we can only assume that the wolfishness is the result of Dracula's influence, because we never get any explanation for why he is a wolf or wolf man.
Yeah, but it disappears the second Armand is destroyed. Mm-hmm. So you can just kind of assumed. So,
and I think that might be one of three visual effects that are done throughout the film. Because there's this transformation sequence, and then there's two more later in the film. And we should also mention that this film is 1 hour and 9 minutes long.
Yeah, it's a short one.
It is a very short film.
Yeah, it's pretty short. So we cut 24 years later.
They didn't have much to say. sorry. Continue. I'll stop shitting on this film only relentlessly.
The budget only allowed for so much film. We cut to 24 years later, and the Scotland Yard detective, Sir Frederick Fleet, is reading the deceased Professor Saunders' account of the previous events that we just witnessed in the film. So he informs Lady Jane that if the body they staked was alive at the time, she's going to be charged with murder because, again, not completely ridiculous for most people to read this and go, oh, okay, you just kill, like, a person, basically. And Lady Jane explains that, you know, nope, he was a vampire, the 18th century vampire expert named Armand Tesla. And then, trying to look at my notes here, if I had anything. I think it was in this scene. I forget if it was Saunders' account or what Lady Jane says, but it's like Tesla's morbid thirst for knowledge turned on him. And I just wrote, God, can I become a vampire then? I have a morbid thirst for knowledge. So
yeah, it's like if you just want to know things, do you eventually just turn into a vampire so you can just keep knowing things?
See, you know, like, and that's one of the things I've always thought would be super cool if you're a vampire. I'm just kind of like, oh, I just have so much more time to do everything I want to do. You know, like obviously there's the whole after a couple hundred years, you can start to lose your mind a bit. But, you know, you just got to keep yourself busy. You can like become a master of so many things.
Yeah. Like Edward and his musical abilities.
Like Edward's at this point, like a doctor, a prolific pianist, you know. Yeah. They don't have to sleep. So Lady Jane tells her son, John, about the investigation, but she's pretty certain that Sir Frederick will find that Armand's body is not decomposed, proving he is a vampire. So she and John agree to keep this information from John's fiance, who is none other than Professor Saunders' granddaughter, Nikki, the girl that was attacked earlier by Armand. So they just decide not to tell her to avoid kind of upsetting her or, you know, opening that old wound and exposing her to like that trauma again. So we come back to the cemetery, and this is where we get kind of our first very explicit moment of, oh, it's 1943 and it's Britain and it's World War II because the Blitz is going on. So there is a bombing raid, and two cemetery workers find Armand's corpse exposed with metal spikes still in his chest. So they think it's bomb shrapnel, and they remove it. And so he's kind of freed from death. And this is interesting, because this is like the first time where, you know, staking a vampire didn't kill them. It just kind of paralyzed or kept them in permanent paralysis.
I also found that very interesting, because that's the first time that we're seeing it. And it's like an interesting, just like, how does that work? Like, they've just been put on pause, because, and that's the thing. It's like, why would they stake him knowing that that was not a permanent solution?
Because did they know? It doesn't, I mean, maybe.
Yeah, because she's like, oh, his body should be there totally fine. And it's like, why would you make that assumption? And if you knew that, why would you not try to kill him for real?
I think the only the surest vampire deaths I've ever seen is in True Blood, where they literally explode if you stake them. Like, they're not
Abigail,
coming back.
And Abigail.
And Abigail. Also explode. And of course, yeah. And Abigail. Coming next yeah. week. So
yeah. One other thing that mm-hmm. I found sweet about mm-hmm. that moment that was that they say that every man, I can't remember the exact line, but they basically say that every man deserves a proper burial and a proper grave, mm-hmm. Which I think is, I mean, it's a nice idea. And it also makes a lot of sense for the time, because this mm-hmm. was the first, like, these World War I and World War II were the first experiences of, like, mass death on, like, a global level. And so it makes mm-hmm. sense that people were very concerned with the idea of, you know, what happens with our bodies and our corpses, because, right. you know, World War I, we'd never seen people die in such numbers. And so mm-hmm. this idea of, like, and then, you know, obviously with World War II, like, mass graves were something mm-hmm. that were much more, I think, on the public's mind. And the idea of, like, getting a proper burial, having your remains treated with respect, was probably, like, very prevalent in terms of the kinds of, one of the things that people would be talking about in terms of the war. And, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. it's very true. I mean, I think we talked about in one episode that modern embalming came from the Civil War, and because bodies mm-hmm, needed mm-hmm. to be delivered back to their families. So I think that that's another yeah. kind of more subtle way that we see the mark of World War I and World War II on this film.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good point. So Andreas, or not Andreas, Armand the vampire has now essentially been resurrected. And mm-hmm. so he finds Andreas, and the Bela eyes come out. "Look at me," he says.
Yes.
And then Andreas can't resist, and the hair returns, thus indicating he is back under Armand's sway. And so mm-hmm. Andreas murders Hugo Bruckner, who is a scientist that had recently escaped from a concentration camp and had yes. arrived in England to work with Lady Jane. Like, wow, that's
yeah. There really
incredibly
isn't much
depressing.
Made of the fact that yeah, like this like scientist was snuck out of a concentration camp and then successfully smuggled over the Channel, and then
right.
we don't even see his death. There's really no significance placed on the fact that this man survived the unsurvivable, persevered yes. in impossible circumstances, and then was killed by a fucking wolfman off screen.
Yes, it's so ludicrously horrible. But uh-huh. I think that also speaks to the ignorance that the American mainstream had of what a concentration camp was then, because it's 1943. Mm-hmm. I mean, D-Day hasn't happened. The U.S. soldiers haven't seen what's in Europe yet. So uh-huh. I, again, it's kind of like it speaks to a flippancy born of ignorance, akin to Rick in Casablanca saying to Ilsa, like, if they catch us, then we'll both be put in a concentration camp. It's like, again, I don't think we necessarily understand the implications of what that meant at yeah. the time, because Casablanca is a yeah. movie from, I want to say, 1940. I could be wrong. And this is mm-hmm. a movie from 43, and the World War II is still very much going on. So again, flippancy yeah. born of ignorance.
Yeah, it's like it. You get the sense that they see it more as like a jailbreak situation.
Yeah, or like a prison camp, not what we know it to be now.
Yeah.
So. Mm-hmm. So now Armand will be impersonating Bruckner, and with his body missing, Sir Frederick closes the investigation, lack of evidence. So Lady mm-hmm. Jane is throwing a party to celebrate John and Nikki's engagement, And she discourages Sir Frederick from giving Saunders' manuscript to Nikki, locks it in a drawer, again, very much like we want to protect Nikki, which on the one hand is very nice. I think they're just being sensitive to the fact, but also could be a little bit of a, well, she's a woman and she can't handle the, I don't know, the ugliness of life, maybe, yeah. or like the horrors of what occurred yeah. to her, maybe. Again, it's that's I would a agree common with that. Thing. Yeah, that's a common thing, especially as we see with a lot of these vampire movies, actually, where there's like a Scooby gang that has to defeat a vampire. There's always a female character that they have to beat. Yeah, no, there is. There's always a female character that they like. It's awful because usually the main female character is, you know, victimized the most by the vampire. Yes. But everyone else insists yeah. on keeping her as ignorant as possible of what's going on to protect her. It's like,
yeah.
give her the facts. Let her know what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. She would probably be able to, these female characters would probably be able to like defend themselves a bit better or to, it is pretty unethical to, especially some of the films where they've been like psychically controlled and people are still lying to them and they're coming in and out of these like fugue states and no one is being upfront. Like, I think there's one film where, is it Dracula's Daughter, where the woman who's in that role, she has a really emotional scene, I think with her fiance, where she's like, what's happening to me? Yeah. I'm scared. I don't know what's happening to me, but I know that it's terrible. And yeah. even in that moment, no one really says, like, we're pretty sure this is what's happening to you. Mm-hmm. And so you're right. It is very messed up that these women keep being continuously kept in the dark, even as they're trying to survive these, like, weird acts of violence.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And so the manuscript is stolen and put in Nikki's room. She reads it and falls under Tesla's power. The energy yes. from her body created the, like, I,
yes. She hears his voice in her mind, and I think she remembers his eyes yeah. staring at her.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I also just, I came up with a name for the trope of, like, whenever we just see the vampire just appear amongst, like, high society gatherings. I'm just like, vampire infiltrates high society. They're just always, like, appear. And everyone's like, oh, who is this fabulous person?
You're right. We have had that happen so many times where everyone's like, oh, the hot new thing on yeah, the town. You yeah. know.
Man, woman, it's, you know.
Yeah. Show up in a fancy outfit. Intrigue yeah. people with your mysterious accent.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. So Armand says, you are mine forever. And I think I wrote, this is kind of the first vampire film where the male presenting vampire voices a kind of explicit intention to have the human woman be his bride. It's always kind of just been implied in previous films, but this is I think the first one where it's like, you are mine forever and all that vampire bride stuff.
I think so. Yeah. I think this is the first time where it's 100% clear that the plan is not to drain and kill the woman. Because yes, Dracula's yes, daughter, exactly. it was clear that she was like looking for a companion towards the end. But you're right that for...
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, for a male vampire. This is, and I mean, more specifically for Dracula, this is the first time that we've seen him explicitly be like, I'm seeking a bride for the after the undead yeah. life, rather than like, your blood yeah. smells so good.
Yeah, yeah, munch, munch, no crumbs. So...
That was just really, really funny. True though. Yeah.
Yeah.
These vampires are much less wasteful. The further we get into the future, the more yeah. wasteful vampires become in terms of like
because...
not wasting a drop, you know.
Yeah, because we can have gore now. And so now it's just they're giving themselves facials, basically. It's like that is yeah. precious life force for you. And you're just burying your face in.
Yeah,
it's so silly.
Like, I saw Tumblr post or something where someone was like, watching vampires drink blood in movies is like you were hanging out with a friend and they bought a Coke and shook it as hard as they could and then blasted it into their face and was like, oh, that was so refreshing. Yes. I need five more.
It is. It really is. Yeah. No, it or like I said with the facial, it's just like you buy this, I don't know, you grab a smoothie and you just like start smearing it on your face like, and
yeah.
Oh my gosh.
It's just like not a very effective way.
It's like you're not getting a lot of that into your system. That's why I always appreciate when I think I've only seen it in the Werner Herzog Nosferatu, but like when he's drinking the Mina character's blood, he looks like a fruit bat. And I appreciate that.
There's a moment in Interview with a Vampire, the TV show, where Lestat is talking to Louis and he's like, Louis, you drink the blood, not bite it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, he's like, suck, don't bite. And, you know, that's funny considering Lestat just like punched a hole through a guy's face in the previous episode and like just does the classic like vampire facial. Again, I get it. You know, we got to have something visual and to show their monstrosity in the show, but yes. Anne Rice was very much these vampires like are very careful when they drink blood. They don't do all of that ridiculous like blood and gore stuff. So it's just kind of like, yeah, well, you know, gotta medium changes, you know, different medium. So
yeah, and I think the things that we find interesting about vampires have changed.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. So. Yeah, again, really curious to see what new Nosferatu does with the more monstrous aspects of the character, how the film presents that.
Yes, for sure.
So Nikki is found unconscious with puncture marks on her neck. Lady Jane questions the grave diggers who tell about the spiked body. And then she tells the story to Sir Frederick, who dismisses the vampire stories as fantasy. And I'm not sure if it's this scene, but it's just one of these scenes. It's like, God, Jane is such a badass queen because she just says something like something is going to be done when they're like something has to be done about this. She's like, yeah, something is. And, you know, goes off to, you know, basically hunt Armand herself as our first female vampire hunter, which is awesome. So Sir Frederick assigns two plainclothes men to shadow Andreas. And they report seeing him transform into a werewolf and recover a bundle containing the effects of the real Bruckner. So Frederick's suspicions grow when laboratory analysis of the drawer finds it to be wolf hair. So they basically know about Andreas.
Laboratory analysis, they look at it with a magnifying glass.
Look, this is just what Wikipedia tells me. So I'm too lazy to do a plot summary myself.
No, I noticed that too. I was like looking at the wiki and I was like, laboratory analysis, like very generous for what they're doing, which is they look at it with a magnifying glass.
It's like some top tier scientific analysis work there. So Armand preys on John and convinces Nikki that she did it. And John is found the next morning unconscious with puncture wounds. So Nikki believes she's becoming a vampire. So Sir Frederick corners Andreas for questioning, but as he begins to transform, Andreas escapes. So now Frederick assigns two men to follow Armand, but the vampire eludes them. And then Armand threatens to turn Nikki and John into vampires. And in this scene, it's his confrontation with Lady Jane. And I really liked this scene. I think it's when she's playing at the piano or the organ. She's just like,
yeah,
it's like very, I just wrote Lady Jane playing that piano a la Phantom of the Opera. Just,
It's the one time the music feels like it's really working with the film and like working for the film.
Yeah. And, she's just so steady and sure. And it's basically pause. Yes. So Lady Jane is just really steady and awesome here. And it's, it's a confrontation scene kind of similar to the one between Dracula and Van Helsing in the Dracula movies, which is just really cool. And so she says, with all of your scientific knowledge, you have achieved nothing. And she, you know, what does she do? She brandishes a cross, warning Tesla that the power of goodness can still destroy him, and Armand vanishes. So again, we come to the very common recurring theme that we've been seeing of, like, you know, science, meh, but we need, like, religion and the powers of God and goodness and strict, you know,
love, a strict triumph love, over evil.
Yeah, exactly. Like a very binary and, you know, strict moral understanding of, like, good and evil. That's very much tied into Christianity. And so Armand commands Nikki to leave the house, and Lady Jane convinces Frederick that they have to follow her. So Nikki meets Armand and Andreas at the cemetery during an air raid and faints. Andreas attempts to carry her to safety, but Frederick shoots him. He and Lady Jane take shelter from the bombing, and at the ruins of St. Matthias's church, Armand abandons Andreas and tells him to die. Andreas crawls into a corner and grasps a crucifix and is freed from the vampire's power.
It's so horrible. It's so horrible the way that he's like, don't let me die, please, you promised me. And he's like, crawl away and die. You know, it's pretty brutal.
Yeah, I mean, fledglings in vampire media don't have a good track record with being, like, treated well by their bosses. So
it's true.
I mean, or familiar. We need to clarify. Fledglings is like the new vampire and the baby vampire. Familiar is the human assistant to the vampire. And so,
or a thrall.
So Armand,
a thrall is someone under the psychic influence.
Yes. So to quote BC from New York Times in 1943, Andreas finds religion or something and then dies.
He hears Jane's voice in his head, which is really interesting.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, because
there's almost
he had
this implication that she has similarly brought him under her influence, you know, where, because, like, a big thing that we see is that people hear Armand Tesla's voice in their heads, talking to them, influencing them. And then the same thing happens to Andreas, where he hears Jane's voice in his head influencing him. And, like, you could just read that as him kind of being in the, you know, he's very close to death. He could just be thinking those things to himself to comfort him. But it is interesting, I think, the way that that mirrors how other characters hear Tesla's voice in their head.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And so Andreas attempts to destroy Armand, and a bomb strikes the church. And I think I wrote, well, we can say it's the first vampire knocked out by German bomber planes. So
what was it that you said yesterday? I never expected to watch a vampire film where everyone lived because of the Blitz.
Yeah. Pretty much. So thanks, World War II. You saved them, because a bomb strikes the church and the rising sun's rays reduce Armand to dust, or to bones, because the church was destroyed.
He kind of melts. He looks pretty juicy when we see him.
Yeah, he does have a kind of gory death. So Andreas dies of his bullet wound. Nikki tells Frederick and Lady Jane that Andreas saved her life. So we kind of, you know, for all of the problematic coding of Andreas's hairiness with him being bad, he does get a really good character arc, I feel like. Or the film shows a lot of grace to him at the end. And Lady Jane tries to convince Frederick that Armand was a vampire, but he refuses to accept her version of events without physical evidence. And then I think And then they have like the, was it the narrator or the on-screen text that was like, and do you, oh no, he looks directly at the camera, I think, and do you people?
It's awful. He asks the two plainclothes officers if they believe, and
oh,
then
yeah,
he
that's right.
literally turns to camera and says,
so,
what do you, like, do you believe? It's terrible.
It's terrible, but again, terrible. This is what we've been seeing in these vampire movies, where it's just like we have to have this ending moment of levity for all of the spookiness that just mm-hmm. occurred. So we have this really mm-hmm. tonally dissonant Frederick looking at the camera, being like, "Do you?" Ha ha ha.
This is the
while
first,
like like while a church has just been bombed by German bomber planes.
Yes.
So like, okay.
This is the first one that has broken the fourth wall that we've covered, where historically this is the first time that we've had, like, he makes eye contact with the camera and he speaks directly to us. And so that's like, we have had a lot of films that end with this like weirdly funny moment that falls very flat. But this is the first time that we've had like a full fourth wall break, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, it's weird, it's dumb, and we don't like it. But that is the end
bad.
Of the return. It's really bad. I mean, not unlike this movie. So that is the end of the return of the vampire. So Elliot, thoughts? What'd you think?
I mean, I think it's pretty clear that neither of us liked this film.
I think I liked it. A little more than you did, solely because of Lady Jane, because I'm just like, wow, I love it. We have our first female vampire hunter, and she's great. She's awesome.
Yeah.
She knows what she's doing.
Yes. I would say that she's probably like the most main character in terms of,
yes.
I'll try to be more positive. I'll say some things that I liked. I really loved the way they introduced Dracula, that shot of his hand buried in like the silk lining of his coffin as he opens it was very beautiful. One thing that we didn't mention was that you don't see Armand Tesla's face for the first like 20 minutes of the film.
Yes.
Which is a long time considering this film is 69 minutes long. And so, you know, like we see his silhouette, we see him from behind, but they hold back on actually showing us his face.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I think that, you know, the return of the vampire, the return of Lugosi to playing a vampire. So I felt that they appropriately built that up, because there definitely is, and we see this more and more so now, there's an appropriate time to reveal the monster in a horror movie.
Absolutely.
You know, where like you don't want to wait too long, but you definitely don't want to do it too early. So
mm-hmm.
I felt like they kind of handled that pretty well. One sad mm-hmm. thing, though, is that, you know, I was like, wow, he looks old. He's really aged a lot in these 11 or 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know this, but you said that he had like a really severe morphine addiction that could have. Laughing, but like that probably explains why he looked so old.
Bela Lugosi certainly struggled with substance abuse issues, and I believe it was predominantly with morphine, which certainly affected his career.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sad, but
mm-hmm.
it's kind of just like, well,
yeah,
that is the reason he probably looks older and
mm-hmm.
Not a very long amount of time.
Yeah, I think thinking about kind of the bigger picture of the film, or I guess thinking about other things, there were some, because initially I had in my notes that Nikki was the only good actress, but I don't think that that's actually true upon reflection. It's so
mm-hmm.
interesting to me, because for me, this film does not work. You know, it's not like successful
mm-hmm.
to me. And it's hard for me, I'm thinking about it, and it's hard for me to put a finger on why, because it's, well, one thing is that I don't think that there was anything that really truly stood out to me that much.
The
cinematography was perfectly acceptable. like the costumes and the wardrobe were like also totally acceptable to me. You know, they were par. I did note that like we get the quintessential moment of Nikki in her ridiculously fancy nightgown or dressing gown when she's reading the notes. So we always have to have a moment of the victim alone in her bedroom in this kind of absurd getup.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Nothing as fabulous as the Spanish language Dracula though.
Yes.
Oh, those nightgowns. Yeah. Like they're black silk negligees.
Yes, yeah. But so, I think like the it's interesting because I don't know what it is, because I don't think it's very well directed. I don't think that it doesn't feel like there's, it feels like one consistent like level of drama, where to me, like, I didn't really feel like high or low stakes. Like, I didn't feel like there were moments where like the drama and intensity really like skyrocketed, you know, like everything to me felt of equal significance, equal importance. And that's like not what you want in a film, especially not a horror film.
No, no, I agree. It was not, a especially scary or suspenseful film. It wasn't an especially compelling drama or romance, or like it wasn't even a comedy. It just it's just such a there film.
It's very unfocused, I think.
It's unfocused.
But
I think
too simple.
Yeah, it's a very simple movie. It's taking, as we keep saying, like we're referring to other movies we have watched, which are bad in their own ways, but they were doing something new or different, or there was an attempt. And I think watching this movie, I'm kind of like, I'm just watching a movie doing all these things that I have seen previous vampire movies do better.
Yes.
And yeah, like for example, you want to see Bela Lugosi rock a vampire role, just watch him in Dracula. You want to see, you know, films that take risks with vampires and you know, in themes of like gender and sexuality, watch Dracula's Daughter. Like you can just you can watch all these other, like you want to watch an unintentional comedy, watch like Condemned to Live or something.
Yeah.
Something like that. Like those Sausage Factory.
Or maybe very few. There's very few innovations. And you're right that it just feels totally rote, you know? Like
it's rote. And I think aside from the fact that it's Bela Lugosi playing a vampire, the only other really kind of notable thing about it is that it's a movie that takes place being in World War II, and that is very much a factor in the events of the film. And it kind of speaks, I think, to how most, I don't know this for certain, but a lot of Hollywood films, I think at the time, regardless of genre, you know, you could not ignore or escape the fact that the entire world was at war, and that was always going to be an element of the plot in some way.
I think that that was a really great observation that you made, where I think the most significant thing about this film might be that very illustration of how totally consuming war is. And that even something like a by the numbers vampire movie, it was so omnipresent in everyone's minds and lives that they couldn't even make a basic vampire movie without the war manifesting.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I absolutely agree. So I think, do we have any favorite moments, any memorable scenes? I'm sure you have many, Elliot.
Yeah. Well, I think, I guess one thing that I was thinking about in terms of like, I've been so negative on this film, like what are things that could have made it better? And just thinking about like the point that you raised about the war and stuff, you know, like he poses as a doctor and a scientist. Like, I think this film could have been incredible if it was maybe like set at like in the trenches, and he was again posing as a doctor, but he was like killing his victims instead of saving them.
Oh my gosh.
Like killing his patients instead of saving them. Like that could have been really interesting. or, you know, mm-hmm. like that would be a really radical transformation. But like, and Lady Jane could have been a nurse who catches on and, But another thing is like Andreas, to me, I found his emotional arc the most compelling. Yes. And so the film could have been 100%. About Andreas. Mm-hmm. Like there are so many other more interesting tacks that this film could have taken. And so there are these grains of something where it's like, mm-hmm. you really could have had something. So mm-hmm. I think in some ways it's like, this is where we start to see the weight of doing the same film over and over again. It's like, we're really starting to feel the drag of like, just try something new, do something different. So I think that there's a lot of like unplumbed, or that's a weird way to say it. Like there's just like depth or there's directions that they could have gone in. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I think the 40s
cool
are going to be.
How would it have been if he was a war doctor just killing people instead of saving them? And then, I think that could have been very exciting.
Yeah. And we'll certainly get later on, you know, vampire stories set in World War II, but I feel like it's always in the context of like the Nazi was a vampire. It's like, of course, because it's like evil. And I don't know. I actually don't know how many World War II set vampire stories there are, but I'm curious to see what comes along. But yeah, I think the 40s are going to be not the most innovative or creatively fruitful period for the vampire movies. I think we got to wait. I could be wrong, but I think we got to wait until Christopher Lee shows up.
I think we have to wait until the 60s or the 70s. Yeah, I think the 60s was like a decade of vampires.
In terms of my favorite scene in the movie, it was definitely the confrontation with Lady Jane and Armand. Mm-hmm. Loved it. Love me a good vampire human confrontation. I agree. I think Andreas had the most interesting character arc. I thought the actor did a really good job. Let me see who played him real quick. It was Matt Willis. He was very good, mm-hmm. I thought. And
yeah, great job, yeah, Matt. You're probably not alive anymore, but good job.
Good job. You took the most of this film and this role, and you made it your own. Mm-hmm. that's about all I have to say about this movie. Overall, it's pretty forgettable outside of the fact that mm-hmm. the Blitz is going on in the film and in the actual time period when the film was made. Mm-hmm. And Bela Lugosi's I guess his last kind of top billed role and kind of the only other maybe unofficial time we would see him play a Dracula character outside of Dracula and Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Yeah. I think my favorite moment is, I agree that scene at the organ where she reveals the cross, that's one of the only like truly, there's actual real dramatic tension there. And my favorite mm-hmm. moment, I think, is that shot of the hand opening the coffin.
Yeah, that's a good shot.
Mm-hmm. It's the only time where I was like, oh, they're doing something, like this is nice.
Exactly.
I don't think there was ever a shot that had similar artistic ambitions after that.
No, like you said, it's a very uncreatively directed film. There's nothing noticeable about the direction or the cinematography for sure.
Lou Landers, quit your job.
Sorry, Lou.
Sorry, Lou. We knew you were trying your best. You didn't have that much money to work with.
That's true.
Sure, there was a lot of pressure on using Lugosi appropriately.
All right. Well, should we close out?
Yeah, I think that we have our episode. We have to hold out for 30 more seconds. Because then the episode will be as long as the film. Watching the countdown.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. We're 20 seconds out.
Oh my gosh.
The suspense. this is more suspenseful than the movie.
I still don't think it's the shortest one we've watched. I think we've seen one where it was only like 60 minutes.
Nosferatu. We have hit 69 minutes.
Woo! Nosferatu was only 60 minutes? Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, it was very short.
Alrighty. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to another episode of This Podcast Sucks.
Find us where you get your podcasts on Spotify, Apple Music, and YouTube. Follow us on social media and give us a like.
You can find us at That Vampire Pod on Twitter and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you guys. And remember, stay bloodthirsty.
Catch our next special episode on Matt Bettinelli-Ulpin and Tyler Gillette's 2024 Abigail.